And a very pleasant good morning to you, wherever you may be. My name is Kent, and I am a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Reading this morning from the print edition of the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, June 5th, 2025, and beginning as usual on page one with What's News. Four major automakers are racing to find workarounds to China's stranglehold on rare earth magnets, which they fear could force them to shut down some car production within weeks. Some economists are beginning to question the accuracy of recent U.S. inflation data after the federal government said staffing shortages hampered its ability to conduct a massive monthly survey. Major U.S. stock indexes ended mixed, with the S&P 500 gaining less than 0.1%, the NASDAQ rising 0.3%, and the Dow slipping 0.2%. Boeing will pay $1.1 billion to avoid prosecution for crashes of its 737 MAX jets in 2018 and 2019 under an agreement with the Justice Department. Reddit sued Anthropic for using its data without a licensing agreement, a new front in the battle over how AI companies train their models. Meta Platforms is courting Hollywood in search of exclusive content for a premium virtual reality headset it plans to release next year. A Bill Gates-backed geothermal energy producer said it can help satisfy power-thirsty industries, but at a speed dependent in part on the survival of tax credits, whose extension is now in doubt. Chart and Flowserve, which supply industrial process technologies, agreed to an all-stock merger valued at about $19 billion. Kimberly-Clark is nearing a sale of its Kleenex and tissue businesses outside of North America to Suzano for around $3.5 billion. And worldwide, the Trump administration is redirecting a key anti-drone technology earmarked for Ukraine to American forces, a move that reflects the Pentagon's waning commitment to Kyiv's defense. Trump said Putin told him that he would respond to Ukraine's recent attack, damping the prospects for immediate peace between Russia and Ukraine. Trump ordered an investigation into Biden's actions as president, including his use of an auto pen, alleging his predecessor's aides hid evidence of what he called Biden's serious cognitive decline. Trump's tax and spending megabill, as now written, would increase budget deficits by $2.4 trillion over 10 years, a Congressional Budget Office estimate calculated. Harvard was suspended from participating in the student visa program, effectively preventing foreign nationals from attending the nation's oldest and most prominent university. The Trump administration attacked Columbia University's accreditation, arguing it is in violation of federal anti-discrimination laws. The president signed a sweeping travel ban on 12 countries, largely in the Middle East and Africa, and introduced more limited travel restrictions on 7 others. And a federal judge in Colorado blocked the deportation of the family of the man accused in Sunday's incendiary attack in Boulder, Colorado. And staying on page one, for the lead story in the paper and exclusive to the journal this morning, entitled U.S. is redirecting critical anti-drone technology from Ukraine to U.S. forces. And it's written by Michael Gordon. Dateline Washington. The Trump administration is redirecting a key anti-drone technology earmarked for Ukraine to American forces, a move that reflects the Pentagon's waning commitment to Kyiv's defense. The Pentagon quietly notified Congress last week that special fuses for rockets that Ukraine uses to shoot down Russian drones are now being allocated to U.S. Air Force units in the Middle East. The move comes as President Trump said Wednesday that Russian President Vladimir Putin told him in a phone call that Moscow would have to respond forcefully to recent Ukrainian attacks, dampening the prospects for a halt in the war that began in early 2022. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth skipped a meeting Wednesday at North Atlantic Treaty Organization headquarters with European defense ministers on coordinating military aid to Ukraine. Hegseth has warned that European allies must provide the overwhelming share of future military assistance to Kyiv, while casting the Western Pacific as the Pentagon's priority theater. The defense chief went further in an internal memo last month. In it, he authorized the Joint Rapid Acquisition Cell, a Pentagon office that ensures commanders' weapons needs are met, to provide the fuses to the U.S. Air Force, even though they were initially bought for Ukraine. The Pentagon told the Senate Armed Services Committee in the previously undisclosed message that the U.S. military's need for the fuses was a Secretary of Defense identified urgent issue. The Pentagon declined requests for comment. The decision to redirect the component illustrates the scarcity of crucial defense items as Ukraine steels itself for more Russian drone and missile attacks, while U.S. Air Force units in the Middle East prepare for a possible conflict with Iran or renewed fighting with Houthi militants in Yemen. Supporters of the move say the Pentagon has the flexibility to take such an action under the emergency military spending bill passed last year. But the move had prompted concerns among Ukraine supporters in Congress, who say that the Pentagon hasn't explained what effect the move would have on Ukrainian defenses or whether the Air Force need is urgent. This capability is urgent and vital to Ukraine's layered air defense against Russian attacks, said Celeste Wallander, who served as a senior Defense Department official during the Biden administration. But there is also an urgent requirement to protect U.S. personnel and bases in the Middle East against Houthi and potentially Iranian drone attacks. The Biden administration arranged to send the fuses, along with numerous other weapons systems, under the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative, which authorized the spending of billions of dollars in U.S. government funds to buy weapons and components from American defense companies. Though the funds for the program have been expended, deliveries are scheduled to reach Ukraine this year and next, unless the Trump administration diverts more systems to fill the U.S. military's inventories. The Trump administration inherited the authority to send Ukraine as much as $3.85 billion in weapons from the Pentagon stocks, but refrained from doing so. It hasn't asked for more funding for the Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. The fuses are intended for the Advanced Precision Kill weapon system. The U.S. has provided that technology to Ukraine for a couple of years, and the Ukrainians have used it in a ground-to-air rocket system for defending against Russian drones. The Pentagon has touted its effectiveness. A critical component is the proximity fuse, which detonates explosives when the rocket nears a drone. The Air Force has adopted the rockets so that they can be fired by F-16s and F-15E jet fighters against drones. The system is cheaper than Sidewinder and AMRAAM air-to-air missiles. A photo of an F-15E equipped with the rocket pods was recently posted by the U.S. Central Command. The Senate Armed Services Committee is looking into ramping up production of components for the counter-drone system, including through the current reconciliation bill, said one congressional aide. He praised the Pentagon for promptly notifying lawmakers of its decision to redirect the fuses so the Congress could take it into account in its budget deliberations. But a Democratic congressional aide was critical. "Denying Ukraine desperately needed weapons at this critical point in the war is unthinkable," he said. "Failing to explain the necessity of this move suggests that it may be punitive." Staying on page one for the next article, Trump is losing patience with Musk's outbursts over megabill. And it's written by Brian Schwartz, Natalie Andrews, and Olivia Beavers. Dateline, Washington. President Trump is losing patience with Elon Musk after the billionaire attacked Republicans' sprawling tax and spending bill. Musk is irked about Trump's decision to withdraw the nomination of a key ally to lead the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The result is a fraying relationship between two of the world's most powerful men. A senior White House official said Trump wasn't happy about Musk's decision to lambaste his signature legislation, describing the president as confused as to why the Tesla chief executive decided to ratchet up his criticism after working so closely with the president for 4 months. The official said senior Trump advisors were caught off guard by Musk's latest offensive. The uneasy alliance between the two men was also strained by a recent move by the White House to nix Trump's nominee to run NASA, Jared Isaacman, according to people familiar with the matter. Musk, a close ally of Isaacman, had advocated for him to get the job. The decision infuriated Musk, who complained to associates over the weekend that he had donated hundreds of millions of dollars to help get Trump elected in last year's campaign, only to see Isaacman's nomination pulled, a person with direct knowledge of the matter said. Musk's frustration over the NASA episode made him more willing to aggressively criticize the tax bill, people close to him said. Musk didn't respond to a request for comment. In a series of social media posts this week, the billionaire called the tax bill a disgusting abomination, and he threatened to try to oust GOP lawmakers for backing what he called an abhorrent package of deficit-fueling spending. On Wednesday afternoon, Musk launched another broadside against the legislation, demanding his over 200 million followers on X call senators and House lawmakers to kill the bill. Trump posted on Truth Social, without comment, an image of Musk's departure message from last week. Trump and Musk have often praised each other in public, with the president organizing a fawning send-off for the billionaire in the Oval Office last week as he wrapped up his work leading the Department of Government Efficiency. But the chumminess has masked flashes of skepticism and frustration from Trump and his aides in recent months, as Musk has criticized the president's trade agenda and clashed with his advisors. Asked whether Trump and Musk continue to have a strong relationship, a White House official said it was too soon to tell. The official said that Trump could be forgiving, but that he doesn't forget slights like this. Even before the billionaires ramped up attacks on the tax bill, some Trump allies worried that Musk would feel more free to criticize the administration after he left the White House. Some administration officials encouraged lawmakers on Capitol Hill to post positive social media posts thanking Musk for his service out of hope such praise could avoid future confrontations, according to people familiar with the effort. Musk has long harbored frustrations with the tax bill, raising concerns about provisions in the legislation that repeal tax credits for electric vehicles, people close to him said. Musk's car company, Tesla, is one of the world's largest manufacturers of electric vehicles. He is also the founder of SpaceX, which has government contracts with NASA. Isaacman has ties to SpaceX, including flying on the company's first private flight to orbit. White House officials privately dismissed Musk's criticisms, arguing that he was focused on his business interests rather than the public interest. After Trump withdrew the NASA nomination, Musk defended Isaacman in a post on X. "It is rare to find someone so competent and good-hearted," Musk said. Isaacman has told associates he believes Musk's departure gave the administration an opening to oust him, people familiar with the matter said. White House officials disputed that the move was aimed at removing a Musk ally from the administration, arguing it instead stemmed from Isaacman's past donations to Democrats. Isaacman noted in a recent podcast interview that White House officials had been aware of the donations for months. Musk's moves have further complicated Republicans' narrow path to passage of the mega bill, which includes tax cuts and border spending, partially offset by trims to Medicaid, clean energy tax credits, and food aid. Musk's tweets re-energized the spending hawks in the Republican Party, but it wasn't clear if it would shift the needle given Trump's strong backing of the current package. The House passed the bill last month, and now the Senate is expected to make changes, which would then need to be approved again by the House before heading to Trump's desk by a self-imposed July 4 deadline. This is Donald Trump's signature achievement. This is important to him. Members had better think three or four times before they decide to get in the way of this victory, said Representative Dusty Johnson, Republican of South Dakota, chair of the GOP Main Street Caucus. The House bill has more than $1.2 trillion in spending cuts over a decade, and administration officials are hailing it as a historic step toward fiscal responsibility. But the bill would increase budget deficits by $2.4 trillion over the period, compared with doing nothing, according to a new Congressional Budget Office estimate released Wednesday. Just 6 months ago, Musk's barrage of social media posts triggered a mutiny of Republicans to kill a government spending bill right before Christmas, forcing hasty rewrites by House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana. But that doesn't appear to be happening in this case, at least not yet. Trump and GOP leaders have stuck with their plan, subject to some adjustments, while cognizant of the difficult math that means even a handful of Republican defectors in the House or Senate could sink the bill, given united Democratic opposition. Johnson said Wednesday he was blindsided by Musk's criticism. He said he spoke to Musk on Monday and walked him through the savings, policy prescriptions, and tax revenue that Republicans argue the bill will bring in. "We had a great, very friendly, very fruitful conversation together," Johnson said at his weekly press conference. 24 hours later, he does a 180 and he comes out against the bill. And it surprised me, frankly. Johnson said he called Musk on Tuesday night and hoped to talk to him on Wednesday, but Musk hasn't yet returned his call. Johnson argued Musk is flat wrong in this case, adding that Trump is not delighted that Elon did a 180, but Johnson says he himself is not upset by this. Representative Thomas Massey, Republican of Kentucky, one of the two House Republicans who voted against the bill in the House last month, was pleased Musk was speaking out. "I figured he would eventually get there," said Massey, who noted the two haven't spoken on the issue. "You don't land rockets backwards or get cars to drive themselves by ignoring the people who are lying to you." And continuing on page one for the next article, automakers race to find workaround to China's stranglehold on rare earth magnets. And it's written by Sean McLean and Ryan Felton. Four major automakers are racing to find workarounds to China's stranglehold on rare earth magnets, which they fear could force them to shut down some car production within weeks. Several traditional and electric vehicle makers and their suppliers are considering shifting some auto parts manufacturing to China to avoid looming factory shutdowns, people familiar with the situation said. Ideas under review include producing electric motors in Chinese factories or shipping Made in America motors to China to have magnets installed. Moving production to China as a way to get around the export controls on rare earth magnets could work because the restrictions only cover magnets, not finished parts, the people said. If automakers end up shifting some production to China, it would amount to a remarkable outcome from a trade war initiated by President Trump with the intention of bringing manufacturing back to the U.S. "If you want to export a magnet from China, they won't let you do that. If you can demonstrate that the magnet is in a motor in China, you can do that," said a supply chain manager at one of the car makers. China, in April, began requiring companies to apply for permission to export magnets made with rare earth metals, including dysprosium and terbium. The country controls roughly 90% of the world's supply of these elements, which help magnets to operate at high temperatures. Much of the world's modern technology, from smartphones to F-35 jet fighters, rely on these magnets. In the auto industry, rare earths are what allow electric vehicle motors to function at high speed. They are also used in less exotic, though no less critical, functions performed by such parts as windshield wipers and headlights. China was supposed to have eased export controls on rare earth magnets as part of a 90-day tariff truce agreement with the White House, but the country has slow-walked license approvals for magnets. Trump accused China of violating its deal with the U.S. China has pushed back at the notion that it was to blame, alleging discriminatory and restrictive measures by Washington, including restricting exports of AI chips and revoking visas for Chinese students. As exports of rare earth magnets have virtually ground to a halt, car makers face hard decisions about whether they can continue to keep some plants operating, according to people familiar with the planning. The European Association of Automotive Suppliers said Wednesday that several production lines and plants across Europe have already closed, with more impacts expected in the coming weeks as inventories deplete. In May, industry groups representing most major automakers and parts suppliers told the Trump administration that vehicle production could be reduced or shut down imminently without more rare earth components from China. While efforts are underway to bolster supply chains and suppliers of these elements outside of China, this will take additional time and will not alleviate the immediate shortage of elements vital for automotive components used to produce vehicles here at home, said the letter, which was signed by the heads of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation and MEMA, the Vehicle Suppliers Association. Shipping an unfinished part halfway across the world to have a chiclet-sized magnet installed adds to the cost and time it takes to manufacture, but the companies see it as perhaps the only alternative to shutting down some production lines altogether. The move could expose car makers to additional tariffs, but auto executives believe the alternative would be even worse. Car companies are also looking at alternative sources for magnets in Europe and Asia instead of purchasing them directly from Chinese factories as they do currently. None of these sources would provide enough magnets to support the demand from the automotive industry, said one company official. The people familiar with the planning say many ideas are under consideration that might not come to pass. The elaborate workarounds being considered underline how reliant the U.S. has become on China for these magnets. The country controls almost all of the refining capability that transforms raw materials into usable forms. Analysts say China has superior technical know-how for separating rare earth from surrounding rocks. American car makers aren't the only ones struggling to source magnets from China. Car companies in Japan and India have also warned of looming manufacturing disruptions. In Europe, automakers say the pace of export license approvals hasn't kept up with their demand. Although some licenses have now been granted, this is currently not enough to ensure smooth production, said Hildegard Müller, president of the German Auto Industries Lobbying Group. If the situation does not change quickly, production delays and even production stoppages can no longer be ruled out. In the U.S., Ford Motor shut down production of the Ford Explorer at its Chicago plant for a week in May because of a rare earth shortage, a spokesman said. The lack of magnets hits EVs and hybrid vehicles harder than conventional cars and trucks. A typical EV contains far more rare earths than a gasoline-powered model, but rare earth magnets are found throughout any modern vehicle. Producing more gas-powered cars instead of EVs isn't a solution because companies would risk falling short of federal fuel economy standards, which could result in fines. Regulatory credits that automakers can purchase from EV makers, such as Tesla and Rivian, to offset their emissions are sold out through the year 2027. Another option to conserve dwindling magnet supplies is reverting to older electric motor technology that doesn't make use of rare earth magnets. Car makers stopped using those motors because the current versions are cheaper and more efficient. Car makers are also considering stripping out some premium features, such as adjustable seats, that make use of several tiny electric motors. High-end speaker systems that use rare earth magnets could also be replaced with downgraded versions. Turning inside the paper for the next article, which is another exclusive to the journal today, entitled "Economists Raise Questions About Quality of U.S. Inflation Data," and it's written by Matt Grossman. Some economists are beginning to question the accuracy of recent U.S. inflation data after the federal government said staffing shortages hampered its ability to conduct a massive monthly survey. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, the office that publishes the inflation rate, told Outside Economist this week that a hiring freeze at the agency was forcing the survey to cut back on the number of businesses where it checks prices. And last month's inflation report, which examined prices in April, government statisticians had to use a less precise method for guessing price changes more extensively than they did in the past. Economists say the staffing shortages raise questions about the quality of recent and coming inflation reports. There is no sign of an intentional effort to publish false or misleading statistics, but any problems with the data could have major implications for the economy. To calculate the inflation rate, hundreds of government workers called enumerators fan out across cities each month to check how much businesses are charging for products such as blue jeans and services such as accounting, often by visiting bricks-and-mortar stores. Statisticians roll those figures together into the Consumer Price Index, a data stream that shows how the cost of living is changing for typical Americans. If the government's enumerators can't track down a specific price in a given city, they try to make an educated guess based on a close substitute, say, cargo pants instead of slacks. But in April, with fewer workers on hand to check prices, statisticians had to base their guesses on less comparable products or other regions of the country, a process called different cell imputation, much more often than usual, according to the BLS. They're having to turn to less effective methods to fill in the blanks, said Omer Sharif, an economist at advisory firm Inflation Insights. He said he has been busy with calls from professional traders who make bets on inflation in financial markets and are anxious about the data's accuracy. The BLS said Wednesday that in April, it stopped collecting consumer inflation data in Lincoln, Nebraska, and Provo, Utah. It also said that it stopped collecting data in Buffalo, New York, in June. The BLS said the changes will have minimal impact on the overall inflation rate, but might increase volatility for the price data on specific goods and in specific regions. BLS makes reductions when current resources can no longer support the collection effort, the agency said. The inflation rate determines how much Social Security benefits go up each year and where federal tax brackets are set. Private sector contracts, such as wage agreements between companies and unions, routinely reference the inflation rate. Payments on $2 trillion of inflation-protected federal bonds hinge on the inflation rate, as do yields on standard Treasury bonds. Businesses, investors, and policymakers rely on the reading to guide their decisions. The Federal Reserve is laser-focused on inflation data when it sets interest rates for the country. A handful of economists noticed quirks in the April data published May 13th. When some asked the BLS for more information, government officials set back an excerpt of an internal report. The CPI temporarily reduced the number of outlets and quotes it attempted to collect due to a staffing shortage in certain CPI cities beginning in April, the email read. These procedures will be kept in place until the hiring freeze is lifted and additional staff can be hired and trained. The Trump administration issued a hiring freeze on January 20 for federal employees, and the Department of Government Efficiency, previously led by Elon Musk, cut thousands of federal workers through layoffs and buyouts. It couldn't be determined if BLS employees were subject to those cuts. The BLS and its parent agency, the Labor Department, didn't respond to requests for comment. Economist Alan Detzmeister of UBS was among those who noticed that in the April inflation data, 29% of price guesses were made using different cell imputation, almost twice as high as any month in the past 5 years. The report showed that the rate of inflation cooled to 2.3% over the 12 months through April, the lowest rate since 2021. Detmeister said it is impossible to tell whether the reliance on different cell estimates skewed the data in one direction or the other. When you take a sample and reduce the numbers, it's going to increase the sampling error, Detmeister said. We don't know if this is a big issue or a small issue, but we just know that directionally it's making things worse. The quality of U.S. economic statistics has been the envy of global policymakers for decades. The system is the product of concerted efforts that began in the depths of the Great Depression to better understand how the economy works. Being able to track what's going on in the economy is very, very important, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said at a press conference earlier this year. It's something that the United States has led in for a long, long time and something we need to continue to lead in. The concerns around the Consumer Inflation Survey follow other government statistics issues that have worried economists in recent months. In May, the BLS suspended publication of hundreds of data series showing wholesale prices for products, including some furniture and kitchen utensils. On Tuesday, the BLS said that it had applied incorrect sample weights to the survey of households the unemployment rate is derived from in April. It said the error had a negligible impact. For years, advocates have warned that government funding for economic statistics has been falling short. Concerns about data quality grew this year after the Trump administration disbanded committees of external experts convened to help improve government stats. You're listening to The Wall Street Journal on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Kent, and I'm a volunteer reader. Did you know if you miss this program or any other program, you can go to our website and listen to it on demand? Simply go to sunsounds.org, then click on Broadcast Info and Audio. And now, on to the next article, which is in the Business and Finance section of the paper. This article is entitled, Dollar Tree Warns of Near-Term Tariff Pressure as Profit Sales Rise, and it's written by Connor Hart. Dollar Tree remains optimistic about its long-term prospects, but tariffs will pressure the discount retail chain in the near term. We expect our second quarter profits to be meaningfully lower than last year in light of higher tariffs and other costs, Chief Financial Officer Stuart Glendinning said Wednesday on a call with analysts. The company incurred about $70 million in additional costs during the period in which the Trump administration placed a 145% tariff on Chinese goods. These costs will run through the business during the current quarter, Glendinning said, adding that mitigation efforts will materialize in the business later in the year. As a result, Dollar Tree guided for adjusted per-share earnings from continuing operations to fall by up to 50% year-over-year in its fiscal second quarter before accelerating in the back half of the year. The stock fell 8.4% to $88.62 a share on Wednesday. Through Wednesday's close, shares have lost about 26% of their value in the past year, despite having gained 33% in the past 3 months. Dollar Tree is managing cost inflation in part by negotiating with suppliers and moving the country of origin for certain products. With these actions, the company offset about 90% of the first round of tariffs, Chief Executive Mike Creedon said. It is currently working through addressing the latest round. The company notched higher profit and revenue in the recent quarter as new customers and increasing trip frequency drove market share gains. It continues to attract customers from other retail channels, particularly higher-income shoppers, Creedon said. Dollar Tree is resonating with its customers in the current environment, he said. Our low prices and smaller pack sizes are perfect for families trying to manage a tight household budget, and our expanded assortment is attractive to all customers across every income level. Other discount retailers have experienced a similar boost. Dollar General on Tuesday reported strong sales in its latest quarter, raising its outlook for the year as the company said it stands to benefit from tariff-related price increases that could pressure consumer spending. For its 3 months ended May 3rd, Dollar Tree posted a profit of $343.4 million, or $1.61 a share, up from $300.1 million, or $1.38 a share, a year earlier. Adjusted per-share earnings came in at $1.26, topping the $1.21 that analysts polled by FactSet expected. Revenue increased 11% to $4.64 billion. Analyst modeled sales of $4.54 billion. Same-store sales, which account for store openings and closings, increased 5.4%. Wall Street expected comparable sales growth of 4%. Dollar Tree's sale of its Family Dollar banner recently received U.S. antitrust approval and is on track to close in the second quarter of fiscal 2025. The company guided for net proceeds of about $800 million, while the economic impact of tax benefits from losses on the sale is expected to be about $350 million. Family Dollar's results were presented in Dollar Tree's financials as discontinued operations. For its fiscal 2025, Dollar Tree now expects adjusted per-share earnings from continuing operations of $5.15 to $5.65, compared with a prior outlook of $5 to $5.50. The change reflects recent share repurchases, the company said. Dollar Tree backed its sales outlook of $18.5 billion to $19.1 billion based on comparable store net sales growth of 3 to 5%. Wall Street expects adjusted earnings of $5.28 on sales of $19.58 billion, as well as same-store sales growth of 3.9%. And still in business and finance, the next article is Kleenex owner strikes a deal for its international tissue business, and it's written by Lauren Thomas and Ben Dumet. Kimberly-Clark struck a more than $3 billion deal for its Kleenex and tissue businesses outside of North America as the maker of Scott toilet paper and Huggies diapers aims to focus on more profitable areas. The consumer products company said Thursday it would enter into a strategic partnership with Suzano, the big pulp producer based in Brazil. Kimberly-Clark said it would own a 49% interest in a new joint venture, which will include basically all the assets of its international tissue business, with Suzano owning the rest. It said the deal values the international tissue unit at around $3.4 billion, including debt. The sale announcement confirmed an earlier report from the Wall Street Journal. Suzano will also have the option to purchase Kimberly-Clark's remaining ownership interest in the future, according to the two companies. Kimberly-Clark's tissue business outside of North America services everyday consumers as well as business customers with products such as Andrex toilet paper and Wipeall cleaning cloths. The sale of that business dovetails with Kimberly-Clark's efforts in 2024 to reorganize into three units, betting that a fresh structure would give it a competitive edge to boost profits and a lagging share price. Kimberly-Clark shares are up about 5% so far this year, slightly outperforming the S&P 500 after having underperformed in recent years. Kimberly-Clark has been working to clean up its house of brands. Last year, it signed up a $640 million sale to Australia's Ansell of a business that makes protective gloves, eyewear, and other apparel. Kimberly-Clark's international tissue business, known as the International Family Care and Professional segment, is the smallest of its three core divisions, with annual net sales coming in under $3.5 billion. The unit has also posted the lowest profit margins of the three, underscoring Kimberly-Clark's interest in selling. A sale would leave Kimberly-Clark with its North America business, the company's largest, with net sales last year of around $11 billion, as well as its international personal care division, which booked net sales of about $5.7 billion in 2024. Any deal would give Suzano a big boost in the global tissue market. In 2023, Suzano acquired Kimberly-Clark's tissue business in Brazil, propelling its overall tissue market share. Suzano Chief Executive Officer Beto Abreu, who took over last July, has said the company is looking to pursue mergers and acquisitions. Last summer, it had to abandon takeover talks with International Paper after being unable to clinch a deal. Just last month, Dallas-based Kimberly-Clark said it would be investing $2 billion to expand its U.S. manufacturing capabilities over 5 years, making a long-term bet on the American consumer. And turning now to the opinion and editorial section of the paper. For the next article, the lead editorial, entitled A $4.5 Trillion Tax Increase or Not? And it's written by the editorial board. We are now at the Congressional Budget Office panic stage of the budget debate as Democrats and the press pretend to care about the federal deficit and debt. The trigger was Wednesday's release of CBO's budget score, one of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which puts a dollar sign on its many provisions. Congress's budget gnomes estimate that the House bill would add $2.4 trillion to the federal deficit over 10 years. This includes what CBO says are some $5.3 trillion in tax cuts, offset by some $2.9 trillion in tax increases and spending reductions. The report kicked off the usual wailing and gnashing of teeth whenever Republicans propose to reduce taxes, though not when Democrats are adding to the debt via spending. Do you recall the consternation when Joe Biden and Democrats passed their Inflation Reduction Act? We don't. CBO and the Joint Committee on Taxation estimated the IRA's energy and climate provisions at $391 billion over 10 years. But the subsidies were open-ended, and Goldman Sachs soon estimated that its myriad green subsidies would eventually cost some $1.2 trillion. One point to keep in mind is that CBO isn't a peerless oracle. It's often wrong. It's estimated that the 2010 federal takeover of student loans would raise money for the government, but it has since cost the Treasury hundreds of millions of dollars. CBO, heeding the Joint Committee on Taxation, invariably underestimates revenue from lower tax rates and business tax cuts. The budget math is merely one factor in deciding whether a bill is on net good economic policy. On that score, this legislation could be much better, as we've written. Its best tax provisions extend the status quo, from the 2017 tax bill that spurred the economy. But the bill also includes Mr. Trump's pet tax cuts on tips, cost $39.7 billion, overtime $124 billion, and social security benefits for some seniors $65.5 billion, and car loan interest $57.7 billion. Take these away, and the bill would add less to the deficit, Senate. Please do. Another point to keep in mind is that the same people wailing about the deficit don't want to touch the main drivers of the national debt, which are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Republicans are taking heat for offering even modest reforms to Medicaid, which will spend 33% more in real terms next year than it did as recently as 2019. See the estimable budget expert John Kogan nearby. The point we'd stress is that if this bill fails, taxes will rise $4.5 trillion next year. Add that to Mr. Trump's tariff taxes, and a recession is probable. Then watch the deficit soar even more than it will with this bill. And on to the lead commentary piece today, entitled A Look Ahead at the 2026 Midterm Elections, and it's written by Carl Rove. Most Americans aren't thinking about next year's midterm election, but leaders, lawmakers, and candidates in both parties are, and for good reason. The most consequential battle across the contested arenas in 2026, the Senate, the House, governorships, and state legislatures, will likely be the fight for the House. It's the most likely to flip from Republican to Democrat, putting a major crimp in President Trump's final 2 years. The House is narrowly divided. There are 220 Republicans, 212 Democrats, and 3 vacancies, all previously held by Democrats. This has made every bill a potential nail-biter. The House passed a Budget Reconciliation Act, the Big Beautiful Bill, 2 weeks ago by a vote of 215 to 214, with one member present and two not voting. If Representative Gerald Connolly hadn't died the day before, the vote might have been 215 to 215, and the legislation defeated. Even with Democrats on their heels, Republicans are looking at a tough scrap. Typically, midterm House contests are hostile to the president's party. Since World War II, the party in power has lost an average of 25 seats in the midterms. The biggest loss was 63 for Democrats in 2010 under President Barack Obama. The smallest was 4 under President John F. Kennedy in 1962. The exceptions were 1998, when Democrats picked up 5 seats, and 2002, when Republicans added 8. These were special circumstances. In the first instance, the GOP overplayed its hand by moving to impeach President Bill Clinton. In the second, it took a 63% approval rating for President George W. Bush a year after 9/11. Even then, it wasn't easy. Trust me, I was in the White House. This coming election will have few competitive seats. Each party gerrymandered where it could when it controlled a state's legislature and governorship during redistricting after the 2020 census. This suggests the elections will come down to brutal, expensive campaigns in a handful of districts. The Cook Political Report rates 191 seats as solid Republican, 11 as likely Republican, and 9 as lean Republican, for a total of 211. That's 9 less than the GOP's number today. A majority is 218. By comparison, the Cook Political Report rates 175 seats as solid Democratic, 19 as likely Democratic, and 12 as lean Democratic, for a total of 206. That's 6 fewer than they have today, 9 if you include the 3 vacant seats. That leaves 19 toss-up seats. 10 are held by Democrats and 9 by Republicans. If Republicans hold all their other seats, they must win 7 of these to reach the magic 218 majority. Democrats, if they held all their other seats, must win 12. Democrats will focus on the 3 Republican congressmen who won, even though Kamala Harris carried their districts. Representatives Don Bacon, Nebraska's 2nd District, Mike Lawler, New York's 17th, and Brian Fitzpatrick, Pennsylvania's 1st. If the Democrats can pick up these 3 seats and block any Republican flips, that will get them to 219. The Republicans' problem is turning out Trump supporters, who may not care about the election if he isn't on the ballot. Though Democrats have history on their side, they still have to overcome vicious intra-party strife and recriminations to nominate candidates who can capture the center while still motivating the left. Money is important, and for once, House Republicans have more where it counts. Their National Campaign Committee had its best first quarter ever, raising $37 million. GOP candidates in tough races fared well, too. As of mid-April, at-risk Republicans had an average of $1.2 million cash on hand. At-risk Democrats, only $657,000. Next year's outcome also depends on what voters think about the president. Most often, Americans punish the president's party in midterms because things have gone wrong for the White House, leaving some supporters irritated or depressed while energizing the opposition. Think 2006, when the Iraq War depressed Republican turnout and drove a tidal wave of Democratic voters. Sometimes it's because the people who feel the U.S. is on the right path because of their president's achievements are complacent, while those frustrated with the country's direction are motivated to get out to the polls. Think 2010, when Democrats were content because of Obamacare, but Tea Party voters were angry. History says Democrats will most likely flip the House, though by a narrow margin. But our politics are unusually turbulent and unpredictable. The only certainty is that the outcome will deeply shape how the Trump era unfolds. And finally this morning, we'll go back to page 1 to read the A-Head story. And a quick little history about the A-Head. Stories sometimes go by the code name of the headline they carry. At the Wall Street Journal, where one bunch of stars and dashes recalled the letter A, the A-HED started out as just another headline code, but it soon became the code name for a story light enough to float off the page. It's been a regular feature on the front page of the paper since 1943. So A-HED is short for A-Headline. And it's typically a quirky, lighthearted feature story to help sort of balance the heavier business news of the day. Today, the A-HED story is entitled, "They Live in a Hockey Mad Nation. They Are Obsessed with an NBA Team 1,000 Miles Away." And it's written by Robert O'Connell. When the Stanley Cup Finals begin on Wednesday night, fans across Canada will rally around the Edmonton Oilers as they try to become the first team from the country to win the trophy since 1993. Puckheads in the Hockey Mad Nation will gather in pubs, in houses, and in public squares, wherever there's a TV showing the game, and enough Labatts to go around. But from Halifax to Saskatchewan, a smaller but no less devoted group of diehards will be breathlessly awaiting a sporting event that features no sticks, not a single skate, and nary a drop of frozen water. They'll be living and dying with a basketball team that plays 1,000 miles south of the border. As the Oklahoma City Thunder chase their first NBA championship starting Thursday, they have an unlikely band of supporters. Basketball obsessives from Canada who have adopted the faraway team as their own. And in Canada, loving a team from Oklahoma City isn't always easy. Chris Graves Smith, who works in banking in Halifax, says the trouble starts with trying to get a bar full of hockey fans to simply turn on a basketball game. "I'd take the Canadian demeanor and probably ask them not to change it in the first place," Graves Smith said. "I think the reaction would be, yeah, we're going to watch the hockey." Still, the popularity of the Thunder is intense enough to have some Canadians setting aside their national sport and their unusually ironclad rules of politeness to flip the channel. The Thunder's appeal in the land of the Maple Leaf begins with two players. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is the Thunder's scoring star and the NBA's freshly minted MVP. And Lugansz Dort is a defensive stopper with the build and temperament of a brick wall. Both are integral to the Thunder, who race to the best record in the NBA this season. And both have one more very important thing in common. They hail from the nascent basketball hotbed of Canada. "Canadians take pride in all Canadian players," said Jojo Furman, a marketing professional in Manitoba who has been following the Thunder since they were the Seattle Supersonics, once one of the closest franchises to the Canadian border. "We're behind them all the way." It's not just that the Thunder have two Canadian stars. It's that those Canadian stars are, well, so very Canadian. Even though they ply their trade in a land of honky-tonks and cowboy boots, their countrymen see in them two perfect representatives of the national culture. Take the Montreal-born Dort, for example. If you added a pair of skates and took away a few teeth, he wouldn't look out of place as a hockey enforcer. "He does all the intangibles," said Dan DeWar, a high school teacher and basketball coach. "He makes the important steal. He makes the block out." And while Gilgeous Alexander from Hamilton, Ontario, is the NBA's leading scorer, he hasn't forgotten the quiet humility of his home country. After he torches some hapless defender with a wicked crossover or fadeaway jump shot, he refrains from any trash-talking. "He's not being overly aggressive after he makes a dunk or a great play," Graves Smith said. "It's like, I'm going out, I'm working hard, I'm doing my job. I relate to that as a Canadian, for sure." Canada's basketball history essentially amounts to one long detour. The sport was invented by a Canadian, Dr. James Naismith, but he nailed up his peach baskets south of the border in Springfield, Massachusetts, and it quickly became an American game. It took more than a half century of NBA play for Canada to have so much as a single All-Star. In the space of a generation, though, the country has started to catch up. Canada's first league MVP came in 2005 via the sharpshooting point guard Steve Nash, who grew up in Victoria, British Columbia. This year's finals matchup features a bevy of players who grew up idolizing Nash and Toronto Raptors star Vince Carter instead of Wayne Gretzky and Gordie Howe. Joining the Thunder's Canadian contingent are a pair of Canadian Pacers, Andrew Nembhard and Benedict Mathurin. Across Canada, the prospect of the Stanley Cup returning home is a point of immense pride. More than three decades have passed since the trophy belonged to the country where hockey is more like a religion than a sport. Still, there's no question among the northernmost honorary suburb of Oklahoma City which series deserves the lion's share of the attention. You know, there's lots of guys in the NHL that are Canadian, so it doesn't matter to me in that way, Dewar said. OKC is front and center in my mind and heart. And that concludes my light reading of the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, June 5th, 2025. My name is Kent, and I am a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. It has been a pleasure reading to you today. Thank you for listening, and please stay tuned for more interesting programs here on Sun Sounds.